Good morning, everyone. I thought since this is the middle lecture of six, I'd give you a picture of where I'm trying to go with this. Many people have come and said, oh, gee, what about this and what about that and what about this? And there are six lectures. And I'm trying to actually set the stage so that in the later lectures, we have a common language. And the easiest way to do that is through working with pictures and having these really simple exercises that I've been trying to share with you. The work that I would like to share has to do with probably one of the most profound secrets of being a human is that you, it's like Ronald says, you are funnier than you look. You are greater than you think you are. You are more powerful than you think you are. Or you have more potential than you believe you do. That's a great hidden part of the human being. And it's unfortunate that the people that have the clearest picture of that have the least power to do it, to change it, and that is the young people. The young people have the clearest picture that they are greater than you can ever imagine, and yet they live in a world where they don't have money, they don't have power, they don't have clout, they don't have cronies in the government they can turn to get things done. And yet they are the ones that have the vision that it should be a better world, it could be a better world, and I am such a way cool person you can't even imagine. They have that very clearly on their radar screens. Unfortunately, the world says, thank you for sharing, please sit down. And that creates a kind of inner urge to change things, maybe outside of the lines, maybe outside of the norm, or it creates a kind of impatience that things aren't changing quickly enough. I have to go out and do something radical in order to get the attention of the world. And in the four steps that I gave from Martin Luther King, get your facts straight and negotiate, very often in radical thinking, getting your facts straight and negotiating are not really options. Acting is the greatest option. Or we could say pulling the trigger is the greatest option rather than waiting to see if the thought process can unfold or I can enter into it or negotiating the parts that I can't agree with or then purifying myself before I act. Those are often not part of radical agendas of activists. And so the reason I'm taking this particular tack in these lectures is because it's my experience that people who are connected to Waldorf have in them something that has been brought over into their adult life of the vision of how it really could be a much better world, really, and how myself really is a kind of sacred thing that needs to come out in the world and express itself. Waldorf kids, all three of my sons have been through Waldorf, and they have the something inside them that says, you know, I'm greater than I appear right now. And the world could be a lot better than it is now. Unfortunately, I've seen that idealism often get twisted by the fact that change is not happening quickly enough. So, what I'm trying to bring to you in a kind of very seminal way, is a few techniques that allow you, if you wish to get a hold of the place where confusion arises in life. And that place where confusion arises about goals, about values, about what is true, what is not true, that is a place Rudolf Steiner calls mental image. And mental image in the work of Rudolf Steiner is a very much misunderstood realm. It's probably one of the most complex philosophical realms that Rudolf Steiner addresses, because it has to do with very, very deep currents in each individual person that they have to go down into their own soul somehow in a lifetime and face the darkness. Everyone has to do it. And I could probably just paint wonderful pictures for you young people about go out and get it and do one for the Gipper and, you know, kick butt when you get out there. But what you probably will find is when you do that, your greatest enemy is your belief about yourself. And that belief about yourself is fundamentally a part of the structure of just how your body wants to treat your sandwich, which is, I'm sorry, sandwich, you lose. I win, you lose. So when we did the little exercise with the rock, paper, scissors, the idea was to see if you could come in contact with just what is the difference between I lose and I win. I've heard some comments, well, I didn't feel anything. Well, that's probably true because it was just a little game. But I can tell you if you had $150 on the outcome of rock, paper, scissors, you would have felt very different about winning and losing. Or if you had lost 4 or 5 times in a row. Some people shared that with me, that they did lose 4 times in a row. Something comes up and says, what's wrong? And that thing that comes up, that's called the witness. That's the one we want to learn how to say, who are you and why are you coming up now in this situation? So in the little game, it may not have come up for you at all. It may not have come up for you in washing the mirror. But Rudolf Steiner is very clear in his work that behind every action, behind every feeling, there is a picture that is in us that is stimulating the will to do something. And that is really the core of what I'm trying to share with you. That when you do something, there is a picture in your inner life that is guiding where that goes. And that picture has a lot to do with how you feel about yourself. An awful lot. And what you say to yourself when you win, and what you say to yourself when you lose, or what you say to yourself when you get what you want, or what you say to yourself when you don't get what you want. When you have to follow somebody else doing something that you don't particularly agree with. So in washing the mirror, you may have been a partner to some person who is doing some strange things that you thought were really kind of silly, and you really didn't want to go there, but you had to surrender to them because that's what the game is. This is called having a boss in the regular world. You know, just read Dilbert. You get a really clear picture of this. Your boss or your company may be doing things that you can't get behind. Maybe your company was just bought by somebody by another company that's making landmines to put all in the ground in Bosnia. And now you're working for a company that's doing that, and maybe you don't really believe in that at all, but there you are having to do it. What do you say to yourself to get to work in the morning?
Why continue working in that situation?
Well, the question is, why continue working? I need a job. I have to pay the bills. I have to pay the rent. It becomes a moral choice. And that's the point I'm trying to make with all of the things I'm bringing to you, is that somewhere along the line, who you are, especially if you're an idealistic Waldorf kid, gets compromised by some things that you have to do in the world. Or maybe you find out you have a very serious disease that's going to limit your possibility to do what you think you need to do. Is there blame in that? Do I have to go into the blame and shame tapes? Do I have to find a perpetrator? Am I a victim, etc.? These are life issues that as you become older, you can't just sweep away with a lot of sweet talk. They come and kind of roost in your backyard and say, here I am. And so when that happens, is it possible to keep initiative and idealism and enthusiasm? And my answer to you is absolutely, it is possible to do that. But in order to do that, you have to do some kind of inner work to prepare yourself. And that's what I want to share with you. And the most effective inner work is that you learn how to control the inner pictures that arise in situations. So the inner picture is an image. And I've been talking about the difference between a being and an image. If I wish to listen to this being in me who lives somewhere in a star and has an agenda for the world, has a destiny to bring something into the world, I have to make sure that what I'm listening to is a being that is really me and not an image that I've received from MTV or somewhere else. I have to be really clear about that in myself. Is this really who I am, or is it an image that I've just sort of pasted on myself in order to feel like I'm a player? This is a very critical point in the world, because if it's just an image, then when I hear that there is great disparity in the world economically, instead of wanting to go and help and change it, I want to go throw a bomb through somebody's front window. And there's a lot of that in the world, going under the label activism. So the greatest activism we can do is to get a hold of the place in our soul where inner images rise up and then result in actions. That's kind of the picture. An inner picture arises, and then I go and do something. Hunger really is an inner picture. Thirst is an inner picture. Sexuality is an inner picture. Having money or not is an inner picture of self-worth. And the inner picture arises, and then actions come out of it. And so if I wish to be able to act in the world in a positive way, in an idealistic way, I need to make sure that the pictures that I'm using or that I'm allowing to arise in my inner life have a certain element of truth to them. Now, truth is a funny word, because we often associate truth with facts. But facts are not true in themselves. Facts are just facts. The truth is the context that I put the facts in. And in order to have a context that's true, I need inwardly to be very mobile in the way in which I work with my inner pictures. I need to have a couple different options for the way my inner pictures interact in order for me to be flexible enough to negotiate. Remember, negotiation is one of the four keys here. So I have to get my facts straight to begin with. But then the second step is I have to be willing to negotiate, even though I think my facts are in a correct form. That means that the facts have to give way to a higher reality. And the higher reality is the person that I meet who has a different set of facts. If I get all hot under the collar and fired up that my facts are better than your facts, then I've lost something of my humanity. My true humanity is that I am large enough in my true self to accept all kinds of facts and to arrange them into different constellations in order to see how the truth moves in your soul and my soul. Because fundamentally, the best thing I can do is to awaken in you. That's the highest I can aspire to, is to awaken in you. But I can't awaken in you with a fact. I can't awaken in you with some concept. I can only awaken in you if I put together the pictures that you put together in order to live your life. Rudolf Steiner says it in a very clear way. He says, you can never awaken in another person with a concept, only with a picture. But the picture has to be accurate to the other person's inner life. And that's where the problem comes in. So I'd like to read you a few quotes about these issues. Actually, one that I already read from Carl Jung on the first day. I'll read that one again. But this one is from Bertrand Russell, who's a philosopher. And he says, the whole problem with the world is that only the fools and fanatics are always certain of themselves. But it's the wisest people who are full of doubts. So if you're full of doubts, it is actually a good symptom. It just means that you are large enough and wise enough to understand that what you know is not the final answer. And that what you know is going to have to somehow merge with what someone else's know in order, someone else knows in order to approach a truth. So I'd like to follow that quote from Bertrand Russell with the first one from Carl Jung, just the first sentence of that. In the process of self-transformation, the worker is thrown back on him or herself and freed of illusion. Illusion is the theme that I would like to deal with today. Or what is the difference between a fact and truth? And so, here is a diagram. If you're from consciousness studies class, how many from consciousness studies are in here? Yeah, there's a couple have been through the mill there. So if you're interested in consciousness studies, talk to some of those people and find out what it's about. But this is a diagram that's on the board almost every second day. And this is a picture of a person. And on this side, here's a triangle that exists in the real world. And on this side, here's a triangle that exists as a concept triangle. And I use this diagram to show this problem of inflexibility, of having to deal with images inwardly in a creative way. In the ancient language, a person that dealt with images, image, was known as a mage. A mage was a person that could successfully work an inner picture. They had control over their inner picture. And when they did that, magic. So a purpose of a mage is to create magic by controlling inner pictures. And that task of controlling the inner picture is at the root of fear and doubt and hatred and anger and getting even and retribution and all of these things that are driving fundamentalism and the will to power. Behind fundamentalism and the will to power is a particular relationship that I have to a set of inner pictures. And then I create pictures and images around me that other people gravitate to, and as they do that, I get control. This is advertising. Basically, magic. I create an image that creates in you an image, and that image makes you do something. That's in the old days, that would be called casting a spell. Today, it's just called advertising. And so, when I begin to realize this, I say to myself, how can I control this inner image? And that's when the doubt starts. But it's the wise people that are full of doubts, according to Bertrand Russell, because they realize that inwardly, the inner picture is causing all kinds of things to happen that they have no control over. And then they wish to change that. They wish to change the way they feel about themselves. They wish to change the way they feel about their neighbor or the person across the street who goes to a different church or the person up the hill that has three BMWs in their garage. Yeah? If I don't have shoes and the guy up the street has three BMWs, I have some work in the inner realms to change my images in order to be in a different place. And so the control of an inner picture is a kind of magic. Now what happens is, if I'm here looking at a real triangle in the real world, my inner forces of my inner life are moving towards the triangle and then back to me with what we could call a sense impression. And then, lo and behold, in my inner life, I have a little duplication of that triangle inside me. We call it a memory. And that memory is a little picture. And then, if I wish to recall that triangle that I saw, I have to go into the other side where all the triangles that ever appeared in the world had their origin in the realm of the idea of a triangle. And I need to pull from that realm of the idea some and duplicate in myself certain feelings of how a triangle is in order to form in my inner life a picture of the thing that I saw moments ago. Rudolf Steiner calls this process soul breathing. And it's happening all the time. It's a kind of much more subtle breathing process than we have with our lungs and our nose and our nasal passages. Now, in the ancient world, the yogis tried to control what they did with their lungs, not so that they could control what they did with their lungs. That was just a byproduct. But the real focus of all that work with their lungs was so that they could get control of the inner pictures that arose from their lungs when they had experiences. That's the real goal of pranayama, is to get control over my inner picture. And along with the pranayama, they had a practice called neti neti. And neti means that's not it, N-E-T-I. That's not it. And if I say neti neti, then that's not it, that's not it. And what they would do is tie themselves to a corpse. that was rotting for days and sit there, and every time they had a feeling of revulsion, they would go, "That's not it." And then they would look and see all the weird stuff happening, and they would say, "That's not it. That's 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 not it." Until they suddenly realized the one who was saying "that's not it" has control over the inner pictures that are arising. When they found that person I have called the witness. And the goal of the work was not to sit by a rotten corpse, was not to breathe, was but to find the person who controlled the inner picture. And since the very beginning, that's been the goal of the inner work of all the mystery schools, is to be able to control the inner picture, especially when I'm in a weird place, or especially when I come in contact with somebody whose ideas are very weird to me, or who I don't agree with. Because then what I do is the inner pictures that arise are not from my higher place, but from my body, which says, like it does to my sandwich, "I win." So when we did the rock, paper, scissors, remember I said, "Kill." That's what I was describing. Not that you're actually going to kill a person, but if you lost, someone was speaking to me, Bruno was speaking to me at lunch, he said he lost 4 times straight in rock, paper, scissors. And by the 4th time, there were certain inner pictures going on in him. Like, what's going on here? How come there must be some kind of strange power this person has who's reading me like a book? That's called vulnerability. And vulnerability means, basically, I lose. If I'm vulnerable, I lose, unless I work on myself. And if I work on myself and I become eminently vulnerable, so that I say really weird and stupid things in front of large groups of people, then they make me a keynote speaker. And then you become a target for comedians. Right, so as I was trying to form these lectures, the goal I had in mind was to present to you, to the young people, the fact that you can control your inner picture. It's possible. It's not easy, and it's definitely not fun to begin with. Because the first thing you run into when you try to do it is that you can't do it. And when you run into the fact that you can't do it, then you feel like a loser. And then you say, well, I can't do this, I never could do this. And the students who have been in my course understand that that's a process. We start our courses in September, and usually by Halloween, everyone's feeling like a loser. Because they've been trying to do the practice, and they've realized that it's a very tough row to hoe to control my inner picture. However, if I can get the tiniest little bit of control over it, then no one can ever take the confidence that I have in my soul from doing that away from me. That is something that lasts my whole lifetime. It's like a reservoir of goodwill towards myself when the world is not providing goodwill towards me. This is the greatest gift I gave it to my kids, and all the, my sons, all of their bosses go, "What did you do with these guys?" And their girlfriends go, "Wow, how did you bring these guys up?" And I brought them up so that they wouldn't be dependent upon me solving their problems. So that they could have something in them to solve the problems themselves. And that's, I wanted them to be mages. Mage, the plural of mage is magi. the three magi, the three kings. So the path of the magi, the path of the three kings who recognized the Christ at Christmas, they recognized in the stars, is this path of controlling the inner image. And what that does is it overcomes doubt. So the fundamental practice is very simple to explain, but very difficult to do, and that is that I form a picture of something inwardly in my inner eye, and I try to hold on to it for as long as I can, and then watch it slowly dissolve. That's as good as it gets and as bad as it gets. And I just repeat that and repeat that and repeat that and repeat that. Now what happens if I start doing that? Suppose I were to ask you to hold a picture of a triangle in your mind's eye. And you form an inner picture of a triangle. Then the first thing the triangle does is it starts to move and change into things. And then you awaken and realize, oh my goodness, I'm trying to hold on to a triangle, but now it's becoming all these things. And that's when the tape goes in. You never could fill in your favorite whatever. You never could do this, or you can't do that, or why can't you, or I, you know, those kinds of things. And that is not you saying that. That's the joker. That's the trickster saying, you never could do this anyway, why bother? And that's the impediment to the inner work, is telling yourself, this will never work. And so what you do in the face of telling yourself this will never work is you say, thank you for sharing, here's my triangle. Oh, okay, right, I hear what you're saying, this will never work, I'm a bozo, here's a triangle. Here's a triangle, here's a triangle, here's a triangle. Now, it's irrelevant that it's a triangle. Rudolf Steiner says, do it with a pin. It doesn't matter what you do it with. What matters is that you do it. And what matters is that when you do it and you fail doing it, you have compassion on the fact that you can't do it. That's the important part. Because if you have compassion on the fact that you can't do it, then when someone else brings something into your life that hurts you, you will be able to have compassion on the fact that they are powerless to solve that problem themselves. And what that does for you is it gives you great strength in adversity. It overcomes doubt that you are a player in life. The world needs young people to hold on to their idealism. Thank the Lord we have Waldorf education that can provide an education to give a certain social idealism to people. And then the question is, as you get to be an adult and have to pay the bills and have to make certain concessions, can you still hold on to the vision that you are a being who has a spiritual dimension? That's really the work. Can I, as a person in adversity, hold on to the fact that I have a destiny that I have had a hand in forming before I came to Earth? If so, what do the things that I am not happy about mean in my life? What is the significance of the challenge or the challenges that have been presented to me? Are they random because I'm a bad person? Or are they specific to some talent that I need to develop further down the road. If I have an intuition that the challenges that come to me somehow are a remedy or giving me strength to overcome things, to give me a capacity to unfold my destiny, then the challenges that I face are much easier to deal with. When I can do that, Rudolf Steiner has a name for that condition. He calls it imagination with a capital I. And he connects it to the realm of moral development. He calls it moral imagination. I can imagine that my trials have meaning. It's a very important gift to give to oneself as an adult. No one can give it to you. No teacher can give it to you. No book can give it to you. No course can give it to you. Only you can give it to yourself. But you have to give it. You have to earn it. And you earn it by being able to control the images that create emotional patterns around the things that you're not happy about, which are quite varied in a person's life and can be, some people are happy about not having money and some people are unhappy about not having money. I mean, people who work in the third world understand that the inner life of people in the third world is often quite joyous and happy, but the outer life is horrible. But in this culture, the outer life is very pleasant and harmonious, but the inner life is where the turmoil is. Why? Because we're afraid of losing what we have on the outside. That was what I was driving at yesterday. So the forming of an image and the holding of an image is the rudiments of a great tool of imaginative cognition or moral imaginative perception. It causes in inner life a kind of process that if it's practiced again and again and again with specific images, a strength builds in me to deal with adversity in a creative and cooperative, well, cooperative, I don't really cooperate with adversity, but I can change the tenor of adversity instead of being personal to being universal. If the things I have to face that are adverse to me have the ring of universality, then I find other people who are facing those same things, and that's when things start to happen and we get mobilized and energy starts to build, because then we have a commonality of the things that we're feeling oppressed by. Then that can be creative. But it can also be a problem, unless I'm sure that the inner picture I hold has truth. So, and that's the tough part about this work. So the forming of an inner picture and the holding of an inner picture is the first step. But now I want to find out whether or not the inner picture I'm holding and the inner picture I'm working with is true or not. In order to do that, I have to allow the inner picture to move around a little bit to form in different ways. In the esoteric language, this is called forming aspects. So I need to be able to form aspects of inner pictures so that I don't get stuck in the belief that there's only one way. So I'll give you a very quick example of that if the board holds together here. So I'm going to make a statement that's a little radical. I'm going to say that I just drew here on the board, that's a triangle. Now, if you're a reasonable person, you say, I'm not so sure about that. Because we know that a triangle is something that looks more like that. But now I'm going to put this in a context. I'm going to take this triangle that you're used to seeing, and I'm going to imagine that it can rotate in space. So I'll use this board. Here's a triangle. There's my triangle. And now I'm going to rotate the triangle. And now the people on that side of the room should see that this triangle resembles the one I've drawn over here. Because as I rotate the triangle, all the lines get compressed until, if that triangle were able to rotate, there would be one view of the triangle where I'd be just be looking at the whole thing like this. In order to do that, I have to not only form an inner picture, but I have to move the inner picture. And the basis of all that, Rudolf Steiner has called eurythmy. The forming of an inner picture that moves in a particular way that is not random. And that I find the movement of it links to something else in the world. When I can find that the movement, maybe I see a movement in eurythmy and it reminds me of a starfish, or it reminds me of the looping of a planet, or the way a tree grows, or a piece of music. And when I begin to do that and form different aspects of the movement of things and can actually morph inner pictures inwardly, then I am creating pictures rather than consuming them. And so the great challenge to this work is the way in which we get used to treating images in the world in which we live. We consume images rather than create them. So the basis of the Waldorf curriculum is creating pictures. Rudolf Steiner himself said, were he to change the curriculum, he'd move it 180 degrees in the direction of the arts. Not to make you artists, but so that you could develop the faculty of being able to control your inner picture. That's what art does. It says, this image is not quite right. I think I'll change it this way, or I'll move it this way. This is a little different here. I'll move it that way. So there are three components to being a mage. The first is forming and dissolving an inner picture. So I practice forming a picture and then dissolving it, and then forming it and dissolving it. The second is moving the picture and trying to see the picture from different aspects. Can I see this picture? Can I see this tree? I'm looking at a tree. I form an inner picture of a tree. Can I see how that tree will look in the fall? Then can I see how that tree will look in the winter? And then do I know how the buds form in the spring? All of those, the spring buds, the summer leaf, the fall, and the winter, all of those together are tree. The being tree. What I see in front of me is not the being tree, but the image tree. The being of the tree is continually evolving, creating different images, and I have to be able to tell the difference between the being and the image. to you to continue using the language here. So, forming and dissolving of a picture, first step. Second step is I try to move the picture through some stages. I make a little flash movie of it, little animation. And I do a tweening. Here's a snapshot, snapshot, snapshot. I try to see, can I tween this into that? How would this move in order to become that? So the faculty that you have to use to do flash, to do a little animation in flash, is the faculty you have to do in order to be a mage, but you do it in the inner plane rather than in your computer. It's exactly the same faculty, except you do it inwardly, rather than having the computing vector power or bitmap power of the software do it, your power of your own will does it inwardly, and it becomes a capacity. And then the third step, if I wish to really develop this organ into something that can be useful to me, is I have to be able to dissolve the picture that I've just moved with and listen intently in silence without anything coming up. And that third level of listening intently without anything coming up, that's where I see or hear the way in which my witness speaks and tells me certain things about how I feel about the pictures. But it always speaks in a silent way. So I have to practice to listen more and more deeply into silence and to cultivate a relationship to silence that allows this faculty or this capacity to develop. Now, unfortunately, in unconscious media consumption, visual imagery, the ability for me to form an inner picture myself is weakened, and in random use of iPod, whatever, the ability to listen and tolerate silence is weakened. And we could say those two forces are weakening the ability for people to form this capacity. So I just bring it to you, not to say they're bad, it's just that if you had to have two or three six-packs a day in order to live, well, you'd probably have some questions about that. If you continually have to have your earbud in your ear all day in order to live, you might have some questions about that. Because there's implications to that, esoteric implications. There's a certain power of silence that is being denied to you. Okay, so some people have said they felt I should be a little more upbeat. little more joyful and leave you singing in the aisles when you leave. But it's my experience that I could have done that more easily before the present administration came into power. There was something that happened for me when the Supreme Court acted the way it did many years ago that said something is terribly wrong. Something definitely needs to be changed, and I don't think I have the energy to do it, but I think I know who does, and that is you. That is you people who still have idealism and energy and thoughts about a better world. So these first three, I wanted to bring a little bit about where the problems are. That's the way I work. And then as we start to go on now towards the end, now we'll get to the feel-good stuff. but I wanted to present to you certain aspects of the inner work that simply require you taking yourself in hand and saying, I have some work to do. I have some weeding to do in the garden, which is not always fun, but it's very nice to get the harvest afterwards. So where are we? Yes, so I would like to give you an exercise here that you could play with. And then tomorrow we'll pick it up and we'll plug it into a partner. And this is an exercise which uses all these things that I've described. So I'd like you to take your hands and hold them like this. And then I'd like you to take your hands and go like this. And then take your hands and go like this. And now, inside your hands, if you had a piece of clay, and you were to squeeze that clay, if you had a ball of clay, and I told you to put the ball of clay and to squeeze it with that form, and then release it, and you could look at that clay would have a particular geometric form. You may know what it is, and you may not know what it is. And what I would like you to do is tomorrow, you're going to find a partner when we start to break out. We're going to start doing a few more exercises. And you're going to describe to the partner two attributes of what that clay form would look like. I can't hear. Okay, so my hands are flat, and now I'm going to make them at an angle like this. So I have a kind of geometric form in here. And then I'm going to change so that my two hands are opposite to each other. And I'll press. And the best way to do this is kind of look around it, or even get a little bit of clay or something. Now, the ideal form here, the ideal form that I have in my hands, fits perfectly in a sphere. The points of that form touch the surface of a sphere. And what I would like you to do is to try to figure out a description so that if we had 9 or 10 different forms made in clay, your partner, based on your description, could go and find that form and bring it to you and say, this is what you described. And you would say, yes, that's what I described. Now this uses all of these things that I've mentioned to you, except perhaps the silence. But if you really want to play with this and feel how this works, then you form it, then you try and form an inner picture, maybe you even draw a picture of it or make a little modeling clay of what you think it looks like, and then dissolve the inner picture and listen. If it is correct, the form that you've made, there will be a very subtle feeling that somehow you're guided to something that is correct. And it's that subtle feeling that this is correct that's the basis of moral imagination. So if you know what the form is and you know what it looks like, then your task is to be able to describe it so that you don't reveal just the name. I don't want you to name the form. Some of you Waldorf kids may have done this in sixth grade, and you know what the form is, and you go, oh, that's a... But that's just a name. I don't want you to name it. I want you to describe it so that someone else could find it who knew nothing about it. Okay? This is a very precise exercise in developing inner picturing, or what we could call inner imagination. So my hands are flat, then I make an angle, then I rotate them so that they're opposite to each other, and then I try to describe what the form will look like so someone else, even someone else who would be blind. So if I had 10 different forms made out of clay on the stage and I sent a blind person there, I said it would be like this and then like this. Then you try to describe it. Tomorrow, when we come back in and it's exercise time, we'll begin with your description. Now, there's a component here. The other day I mentioned dew. And the greatest source of dew is to take something overnight into sleep. So the whole Waldorf curriculum, the teachings that the teachers get of how to teach, is called taking things into sleep. Because when you take an image or a movement into sleep, the dew that comes from it is much more powerful than if you just try to figure it out and come to an answer. So tonight, if you really want to play with this, and you want to have a really good time with your partner tomorrow, right before you go to sleep, you'll try to move your hands, form a picture, make a description, and then dissolve this description and listen into the silence after you dissolve it. If you do that two or three times, then in the morning when you wake up, there will be a very subtle feeling of a kind of inner movement with you. Then when you come back and you meet your partner and you begin to describe it with them, something of the dew of the night will come into your conversation and quicken your relationship to them and to the images that they have. We're going to take that idea a lot farther when we try to build an idea for how can we build community with each other, especially by meeting each other in the night. So thank you for listening.